Supplements contaminated with banned substances. It's an athlete's worst nightmare. It's also become almost the default reason given by an athlete when they first test positive for a banned substance in recent years. In today's episode, we'll dive into understand how much risk there actually is of testing positive from nutrition supplement use, and explore how and why this could occur. We'll discuss how to use supplements safely, and how to minimize the risk of a positive test coming back to haunt you. And if you're not an elite athlete and you don't think this is relevant to you, think again. We'll hear how this issue applies to all athletes competing in organized sport, no matter what level you compete at. Hello and welcome to Fueling Endurance, the nutrition podcast for runners, cyclists and triathletes. I'm Alan McCubbin, I'm an accredited sports dietitian based in Melbourne and have almost 20 years experience working with runners, cyclists and triathletes to help them stay healthy and optimize their performance from complete beginners through to professional and Olympic athletes. And on today's podcast, we're going to answer the question, can my supplement really cause a positive doping test? But before we get to that, if you've listened to our second episode of the T-12 series last week, you'll be aware that we discussed the topic of podcast sponsorship. For almost 12 months now, well before Steph finished up with the podcast, the two of us had been discussing whether or not we would be open to paid sponsorships or promotions on the podcast. We didn't have anything lined up at the time, but we knew that one day or another we would have to provide a yes or no answer when approached. In the end, we decided that we would be open to these opportunities, as podcasts might be free to listen to, but I can assure you they're absolutely not free to make or host. But Steph and I both agreed that we'd only ever say yes to any partnership on our terms. Firstly, we wouldn't do any partnerships, sponsorships, or endorsements of specific foods or supplement products or brands. We both felt very strongly that our role as health professionals means being completely brand neutral when it comes to specific food and supplement products. Secondly, any other partnership would have to be related to products or services we felt comfortable recommending to the athletes and clients that we work with. In the episode of T-12, we mentioned a paid partnership with online sports nutrition retailer Aid Station, who have provided our guest athlete Brett with products that will be available on course during the event he's preparing for, Ultra Trail Australia. Aid Station stock products across a range of brands, so we're not promoting or endorsing any particular brand or product over another, and we always encourage athletes to try a range of different products to find out what works best for them. And in today's episode, we have a second paid partnership, which I'll let you know about later on in the episode. Now, unrelated to either of those partnerships, I also want to remind you about the Fueling Endurance ebook. The ebook provides comprehensive written articles covering the contents of the first 2 years of the podcast, and it's packed with practical tips and suggestions, tables, diagrams, and flowcharts, as well as stories and quotes from expert researchers, nutrition practitioners, coaches, and athletes who have been guests on the podcast. It covers a range of topics, from should I drink to a plan or drink to thirst, to why do I get gut issues during exercise, and is low carb right for me. The Fueling Endurance ebook is available from fuelingendurance.com and for Kindle via Amazon. And the sales of the book help to support the cost of running this podcast, so we really appreciate it. And if you want to get practical sports nutrition news, tips and tricks delivered directly to your inbox every couple of weeks, you can join the Fueling Endurance email newsletter. It's completely free and you can sign up at fuelingendurance.com, and that's fueling spelt with one L. But let's get into today's question now with our guest, Kerry O'Brien. Now, Kerry is an accredited sports dietitian based in Queensland, and he works at both Bond University and the Queensland Academy of Sport. Now, Kerry was involved in an important project looking at whether food products fortified with protein powder could be considered a doping risk in the lead-up to the Tokyo Olympic Games. And it's his knowledge from this process, as well as his work in elite sport, that makes him a fantastic person to help understand the risk of supplement contamination with banned substances and how to navigate the risks involved. Before we get into this one, I mentioned off the top that the topic of anti-doping is often thought of as a problem only for elite athletes to worry about. But no matter what level you compete at, If you're entered in any sporting event that is organised by a club or an organisation affiliated with a national sporting organisation that's a signatory to the World Anti-Doping Code through its international body, then you're essentially agreeing to comply with the wider code, and you could theoretically be randomly tested at an event. And it does happen from time to time, even in recreational events, as we'll hear. Now, this also includes other major event organisers like Ironman, and this is an area currently also being explored in other sports that don't fall under the traditional international and national sporting organisations. So things like trail running, for example, is currently having these discussions about anti-doping as well. So it is a concern at all levels of sport, and it doesn't matter what level of sport you compete at, the last thing you want is to be taken away from the sport that you love because of an inadvertent doping incident. So without further ado, let's get into this conversation with sports dietitian Kerry O'Brien. Kerry, welcome to Fueling Endurance. How are things up there in Queensland?
Not too bad. I think we've got a 3 metre swell out the front, but sun is out. Not as hot as it's been, so a great day up north here. Thanks, Alan.
Yep, awesome. Now, you're a sports dietitian. You work, amongst other places, with the Queensland Academy of Sport. And I believe that you've been working with several athletes aiming for the Paris Olympics later this year in sports like BMX freestyle and surfing, amongst others. You talked about the swell just then. How did you find yourself working in that kind of a role? And what's it like working as a dietitian with athletes in sports that I guess you might traditionally have considered kind of lifestyle sports as opposed to the traditional sports, if you like?
Yeah, well, I guess I have been fortunate to work firstly as a strength and conditioning coach back in 2010, and now as a sports dietitian in a variety of elite sporting organisations for both individual and team-based sports, including rugby league, a union, AFL, sprint, slalom, kayak and swimming, and now as a sports dietitian servicing the action sports, some of the newer sports. So it's definitely an exciting space, and the different cultures always interesting. Often it does take time to become fully immersed, but I love the challenge. And put it this way, Al, I'm certainly very accustomed now to seeing surfing athletes training in the gym with beach towels and no shoes. So, and also my sports-specific vocabulary continues to evolve.
Yep.
One area though, Al, that across, which I'm sure we're going to get into from a nutrition perspective in all the sports I've worked in, is certainly our protein-focused nutrition from an athlete perspective, and questions, hype around supplement use, which I'm sure we'll get into.
Mm-hmm. No, even in those sort of lifestyle sports, action sports.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Cool. All right. Well, today we're going to talk about the risk of inadvertently testing positive to banned substances in a doping test, and that coming from potentially food or supplements. And I guess a lot of listeners might be thinking, first of all, well, I don't care. I'm not an elite athlete. I'm never going to be drug tested. And I guess it is one of the things that you do see, you know, when someone participates in a sport that's run through a sporting club at any level, theoretically, they're falling under the umbrella of that sporting organisation, and therefore that organisation signed up to the wider code. So essentially you're required to comply with that, and theoretically can be tested at any time, even though the risk may not be that great. And just as a side note on this, there was an article that made headlines the other week, actually. There was an amateur cycling race, just a club race in Spain a couple of weekends ago, and I think 130 competitors abandoned the race when they found out that anti-doping were waiting at the finish line. Now, you know, probably some of those people would have abandoned anyway, but the implication was an awful lot of them abandoned because they heard that anti-doping were waiting at the end there. So I guess that's not around the supplement side of things necessarily. But I think the supplements really comes into this because a lot of athletes who have, you know, had a adverse analytical finding, as the technical lingo goes, and tested positive, if you want to call it that, it seems like almost all of them these days are very quick to blame contaminated supplements as the cause of the positive test. And I guess we have seen some, but not all of them have their suspension reduced from, you know, 4 years, which is kind of the standard sentence these days, to often less than a year based on evidence they were able to provide around supplement contamination or something. So I guess what we want to talk about today is that risk of contamination, and I guess as athletes, how people can reduce that risk as well. So there's a few different reasons an athlete might test positive from the use of supplements that might contain banned substances. Can you fill us in, Kerry, on, I guess, the different reasons that that might happen? And is it important that there are different reasons and being able to distinguish between those different reasons as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess most athletes, or if they're not, but they certainly should be made aware that they're fully responsible for anything that is in their system, regardless of how it got there. But you're right, with regard to contamination, positive tests from supplements, that there's usually four main reasons. And the first one would be deliberately taking a supplement that actually contains a banned substance, which is printed on the label. And I do recall a few years ago on the sanction list, which is actually the ban list from the Sport Integrity Australia, formerly known as ASADA, there was a strength athlete that was actually on there, and it was that situation. They were being paid, sponsored by a product, and actually got done, and it was on the label. So certainly not the smartest way to go about it. So we promote as sports dietitians in sport the opposite to that. Doesn't happen often, but yeah, that's one way. A second way could be taking a supplement and not realizing a labeled ingredient is banned. Again, so unintentional, so inadvertently taking a banned substance. Again, that's come back to education and awareness, and actually doing a research or reaching out to people prior to taking something, rather than, hey, I'm taking this, is it okay? A third way could be taking a supplement that contained a banned substance that's not on the label, but is deliberately added by the manufacturer. So, and we will get into this later in the conversation, but certainly that is where it's purposefully been added. And I guess we could think of all supplements is, you know, I always think from the athlete's perspective, is there someone out there, I don't know, putting a banned stimulant in a high protein cereal, for example? That's very unlikely to happen. The reality is the probability of those things are happening at where it's so pre-workouts and aesthetic, so bodybuilder type supplement products, which are commonly used across all sports, that is where the high risk is. And even more so is from imported, so products made outside of Australia, so the US and Europe, from reports, definitely have higher rates of contamination. And the fourth way would be taking a supplement contaminated with a banned substance as a result of cross-contamination during manufacture. And I do have some experience that I can add to this, working and developing a couple of supplement lines and having direct exposure to contract manufacturing, which are the people that actually make these products. And essentially, they use these very large machines called ribbon blenders. They're usually around 400 kilogram batches. And for example, if a product line had been used for a pre-workout mix prior to your product that you were taking, it actually relies on extensive cleaning to ensure that that machine is fully clean. So it's relying on people out of your control to ensure that there's no cross-contamination of residue. And certainly in the experience that I had, and I was asking some fairly pointed questions from the contract manufacturer to further understand it, and yeah, feedback I did get was interesting around a multi-ingredient mushroom blend, which had hit the market, and just the amount of time. It took 8 hours to fully clean the room, the air-sealed room, and the machine, because the powders were just so fine. So it really did cement to me like this idea of cross-contamination and how that can happen, and it's out of your control, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, because I think, you know, there's obviously a lot of people have different reactions, often very emotional reactions, to stories around sort of doping positives that occur, and when they see them in the media, you know, people are quick to judge why that has happened, and maybe, you know, in some cases rightly so, and based on history, and, you know, people are kind of rightly cynical in a way. But I guess, you know, people going, oh, you know, dietary supplements, what a stupid excuse, you know, cross-contamination, as you've just described, it's so hard to clean those machines out, and if they've been used to produce a product that did contain a banned substance deliberately, because it's not saying that you cannot produce a product, you know, it's not like the companies are banned from making those products, just that anyone who's under a sanctioned sport can't use them, and then the next order comes through and they're making something completely different that's not meant to contain a banned substance that ends up inadvertently getting it in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, the other one I wanted to ask you about there, so the first two reasons that you gave there, I think are pretty straightforward. You know, someone deliberately takes a supplement because it contains a banned substance. Well, that's deliberate doping, essentially. The second one there was taking a supplement that contains a banned substance. And, you know, the company hasn't tried to hide the fact that it contains a banned substance, but the person just didn't know that it did contain a banned substance. They didn't realize, they didn't check the label, or they didn't understand the ingredients list on a label. And there have been certainly examples here in Australia of endurance athletes that have fallen foul of that, and in other sports as well. The third one I want to ask you a little bit more about, though. So this is where they're taking a supplement that contains a banned substance. It's not on the label, but it's been deliberately added by the manufacturer, which sounds pretty Wild West. Have you got any experience or, you know, stories of evidence of this happening?
Well, I guess the first thing to address there is how that in our batch test, which we'll talk about now. So there's the way to avoid that is so something we're going to be talking about, which is these independent laboratory in Australia that actually tests for drugs. And there's two that we'll talk about, which is Inform Sport and Husta. Very high level, polished, extensive systems where they test for over 250 banned substances. So these are external or private companies, so that getting access to that kind of information is not that easy. They can't release that information, and we will talk more about that. But certainly, like how often that happens in Australia, I know there was some research, and it's getting a bit old now, but it was like 5% of supplements had ingredients within them that would have resulted in a positive test, which is frightening to hear those statistics. So it's not all bad news, Alan. I see that Sport Integrity Australia, which is the peak body for educating and managing, controlling anti-doping, among other areas of integrity and sport, in September 2022, they did put out a good news story about the impact of athlete education and testing. It was the first time in over a decade that not a single athlete had tested positive due to a supplement in Australia. So certainly respecting that, the things we're doing, and we'll talk about the Sport Integrity Australia app where athletes can test things, but the education and the processes, which is tedious, is taking a long time, and there's more work to do, but appears to be, you know, in the results. We're just not seeing that as much. So there is a good news at the moment. Also acknowledging, though, that the batch testing of supplement products was significantly reduced during the COVID years as most sport was cancelled. However, returning to normal now. So those testing of products is increasing again. And certainly from a sports dietitian perspective, and I'm sure you'd agree, Al, that there's never been more options, batch tested options to offer athletes. And I jumped on the Sport Integrity Australia app last night just to check, and there's currently over 30 different creatine products available. So certainly I preach to athletes, you're not missing out.
Yeah.
There's options.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, I've heard these stories in the past. You're never 100% sure how true they are or not, and whether they still occur today. But yeah, as you said, a lot of it is the kind of the supplements that are aimed at the kind of the bodybuilding and the gym market. But often they are used by people in other sports, including endurance sports, as a source of protein or creatine or something like that. But products where they come out with the latest protein and they want it to look better than all the other proteins, so they deliberately add some banned substances to the first couple of batches, get people going, oh, this protein's amazing, it's so good for me, and then they remove it again because it's too expensive, or they don't want to be caught or traced eventually. But they get people convinced by adding banned substances early on, and then they remove them later on. But if you happen to get that early batch, then yeah, bad luck.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry to interrupt the chat with Kerry, but I wanted to take a quick moment to tell you about our new podcast partnership that I mentioned at the start of the episode. So you may recall in our last episode, episode 74, I chatted to Fuelin co-founder Scott Tindall on the topic of working out the calorie needs of athletes, as this is something that we're both working on together for the Fuelin app at the moment. Now, Scott was so impressed with the podcast that he actually asked afterwards if he could support us in an official capacity. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet and you don't know what Fuelin is or what it does, Fuelin is the world's first training-based nutrition app. And what that means is that it syncs with your training plan from Training Peaks, Final Surge, Tri.dot or Run.dot, and together with some other information you enter into the app, it creates a personalized nutrition plan built around your training schedule and tailored to your goals. You'll see adjustments in your fueling, both within and outside of training sessions, using a traffic light system to adjust your carb intake to fuel appropriately for your particular needs and goals. It also integrates with food tracking apps if you want to use that functionality, as well as providing recipes and meal suggestions that meet your nutritional needs at each meal and snack. There are different subscription options depending on how much support you'd like from Fuelin's team of sports nutritionists and dietitians. And if you would like to try Fuelin, Scott has offered listeners of this podcast a 30% discount on your first month. So if you want to take advantage of that, just head to fuelin.com and enter the code FE30 when checking out. You can also find that code and the link in the episode description. So a big thanks to Fuelin for the support. And now let's get back to our conversation with Kerry. So obviously there's a few different aspects to this in terms of trying to minimize the risk of this happening. So either minimizing the risk that you took a banned substance that was on the label of a product, or a product that had a banned substance in it that it wasn't labeled, either through cross-contamination or through deliberate addition but without declaring it by the company. You mentioned before the batch testing side of things. Do you want to explain that a little bit more now? And is that probably the best way that athletes can go, apart from obviously avoiding supplements altogether, to kind of minimize this risk?
Yes, you're right. The fail-safe way is to avoid supplements. And very rarely I meet an athlete that actually has that stance. They will not take anything. So unusual practice there. However, the safest way to use supplements is certainly to use what we call batch tested. So just to outline what happens there. So a product will be made by the brand, then that product is then sent off as an example. And it's a certification process, which is extensive and expensive, where they will send samples across to this independent laboratory. As I said, they're very large scientific laboratories that actually their main business sources are actually around drug testing for the horse and greyhound markets. However, they also do the human testing of supplements. So they will test for 250 plus banned substances. Then if that product is deemed to be clear, then they will certification. And it's not just a one-off test. It is a certification process. Then the product will be permitted to use. And that batch, it's a batch-specific approach where it's got the logo on there. And even when I'm working with developing young elite athletes, the sooner we get that conversation started, the better. We've got, you know, belief systems from parents. There's so much information around supplements from social media. It is literally coming from everywhere. The age at which young individuals in general are using supplements is getting lower. So working with young athletes, the sooner the better that they know what those logos look like. And certainly the two that in Australia that we're sticking to is the Hustler or Inform Sport. And they're very prominent on the product label. So that's the easiest way. I mean, even the supermarkets have got options now. So once you know what those logos look like, so that's certainly outline of the batch testing process.
Yeah. And just on that, you mentioned obviously, you know, it is an expensive process. So if I'm a supplement maker and I have a supplement that I want to get tested, obviously I've got to send every single batch I make off that wants to be certified and pay for each batch to be tested. So that's an expensive process. And I guess there's two elements to that. Firstly, you know, different companies handle that in different ways. So for example, some companies will sell you the same product. You can buy either a batch tested batch or a non-batch tested batch, and you'll probably pay a bit extra for the batch tested batch. So they're essentially passing on the cost of the testing to the consumer, whereas other companies might choose to just get all their product range done or specific products within a certain range done kind of at their own expense, if you like, or they might just charge, you know, they just up the prices of everything and that sort of covers their cost a little bit. So it is a bit different in terms of how different companies kind of approach that.
Yeah, that is a really good point, Al. And actually, yeah, worth noting. So just because a product may be in a supermarket that's got the IOC label on the side of the product doesn't necessarily mean they're involved in sponsoring sport. That does not equate to a batch tested offering. And certainly I'm sure you've been presented with that before. So it's specific to the logo. And in those situations where very large pharmaceutical or supplement companies are producing those, that's exactly right. They will send off specific batches to get tested and then they will be distributed to the athletes representing Australia, for example. But yeah, the ones on the shelves, it's a different batch essentially
without
the logo.
Yep. So it is one thing you do need to be careful of. If you go to, say, the Informed Sport website or the Hustler website and you're looking up the different products and then you go to those company websites to buy that product or into a retail store or some other kind of online middleman and you're going to buy those products, you need to check that that particular batch that you're buying is batch tested because, yeah, you can have products where you can get both versions and you want to make sure you buy the right version.
Absolutely. And I guess... the easiest way to do that is to recommend is through the Sport Integrity Australia app. So as an athlete, if you don't have that, have a look. It's very easy to use. You can either go on there and look for a supplement specific that you're looking for and find. You'll see batch numbers, expiry dates are there. Otherwise, if it's not on there, it'll run you through a risk tree, assessment tree, and give you an obviously answer before you want to do that prior to taking.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing you said there really jogged my mind is you were saying, you know, the fact that some products, whether they're sports foods or supplements, might have an IOC logo on them or a Cricket Australia logo or a, I don't know, whatever kind of national sporting organisation logo on there because they're a sponsor of that organisation. That doesn't mean that that organisation has approved it as being free of banned substances. It's got nothing to do with that. It's completely separate to the batch testing process. And personally, I've lost count of the number of times I've heard athletes, and I'm talking, you know, professional and or Olympians, say, oh, I can use this supplement. Well, they would have said ASADA approved. And you've talked about Sports Integrity Australia. So just as a side note to this, people are probably, what's the difference? Like, I thought it was ASADA. So ASADA was the Australian Sports Anti-Doping Agency, and that was folded into what is now Sports Integrity Australia in 2020. So ASADA as a term, or as an organisation, no longer exists. The anti-doping aspect is now managed as part of Sports Integrity Australia, along with things like match fixing and illegal betting and other areas of fraud and corruption in sport. So it's broader than just anti-doping now, and it's under that banner of SIA, Sports Integrity Australia. In other countries, it's still things like the UK anti-doping or USADA, US anti-doping authority, I think it is off the top of my head. But yeah, people saying, oh yeah, this product's been ASADA approved or SIA approved or something like that. Is there such a thing as anti-doping agency approved supplements?
Short answer to that is no. And yeah, we've certainly heard that one before. It's a miscommunication. But essentially, any of the sporting integrity associations are never going to endorse or approve any supplement directly. I think where the confusion actually happens there is the fact that an athlete is going through the app, which we promote, and they're finding the product and the batch is on there to say that it's batch tested. Therefore, they think that it's actually approved. Yeah, it's obviously the independent batch testing laboratories that certify those products that are listed on the app. Yeah, obviously a conflict of interest there. We can't have it in Sporting Integrity Australia promoting certain products over others. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even like before the days of the app, I was still hearing people make that sort of comment, oh, yeah, it's ASADA approved or whatever. I'm like, where on earth have you sort of figured that out? Well, no idea, to be honest. No idea where that kind of information might have or would have come from. But yeah, I've lost count of the number of times I've heard it. Oh. So it's an interesting one.
Absolutely. And I guess I'll just to answer the question from before, I think there's no reason why athletes, you know, should think they're missing out on any options of supplements. They can certainly still use supplements in a safe, smart and strategic manner through informed choices rather than an ad hoc approach. And certainly something that I lecture on in the Australian Institute of Sport. It's got some great resources on this around the three questions that an athlete should really ask themselves prior to taking anything. And that is it safe? Is that product safe? Is it some herb or something with no research or mushroom thing that you know nothing about? Is it permitted in sports? That means, is it permitted under the WADA code? Is it a banned substance? Something, again, you can check on the Sport Integrity Australia app. And finally, is there evidence that it may work? And that's obviously towards your performance or health goal, that is. Certainly no shortage of athletes that are hearing an influencer and just wanting to take stuff and just adding something else onto the stack. And I guess it's something that as a practitioner, I do spend a fair bit of time on, is just getting them to understand that and prioritizing. It's not just about throwing everything at it. Let's be very strategic. And look, at the end of the day, they're all expensive too. So if that's at the expense of quality food, then yeah, food first messaging is always in there. So really having a targeted approach is how I work with that, Al.
Mm, yep. And one of the things, I guess, to consider with the batch-tested supplements, as you mentioned, they test for, you know, 250 or more different banned substances, and obviously they're going to test for all the big ones that are, I guess, statistically most likely to have come up on positive tests in the past, I would imagine, and obviously the ones that they can test for. But there's parts of the WADA code, and you know, until you delve into it, a lot of people don't realize this, that parts of the code are kind of open-ended in a way, that there's sections in there which basically say, and any product that hasn't been approved for human use in any form, which could literally be thousands of different things. So I guess the point there is that, you know, batch testing is good. It's certainly better than nothing, but it's never going to be 100% guaranteed that you cannot or will not have a banned substance in a product. The risk is obviously pretty low, but it's not zero.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the point there, Al, that they're not guaranteed to be banned substance free per se. However, it is the safest approach. And I assume, Al, that the testing, the number of substances that they're testing for is going up, so that the best kind of practice of reducing your risk of taking a contaminated supplement is to break that down into three steps. Would firstly be to use the Sport Integrity Australia app to find a batch tested product or identify the level of risk. Secondly, would be to only use batch-tested products. We've spoken about that. And in Australia, Huster and Inform Sport logo, there's plenty of offerings there. And thirdly, would be to take a photo of the product and the batch number on your phone and put that in a folder in your phone. And that's what I consider to be gold standard. Getting athletes to actually do that is a challenge, I will admit. And certainly working with other sports, there'll be athletes like sending me photos. Hey, I'm taking this. Can you upload it? And as you know, as a sports dietitian, with the small benefits that supplement can bring, unfortunately, it does take up a significant amount of time managing supplement programs and everything around it. And yeah, I've got my own biases around supplement use and coming from contact sport, but it's, often you feel like you are caught with spending this time here where you just want to be talking about food, right? I'm sure you've experienced the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that I've often said to athletes, and this is probably mostly at Olympic level, so when you're really getting to where the stakes are super high, where I've actually suggested to them if they're taking like a powdered supplement or even it's capsules or something like that in some form or another, is to actually save, like, don't use the entire tub or packet or something. Keep a few and keep them away in a cupboard for a few years, because if your blood or urine or something is retrospectively tested in 5 years' time and something comes up, you've actually got evidence that you can go back to and look for the proof of maybe that there was some contamination in a supplement or something like that. Look, I think the risk of that happening is exceptionally low, but it's not zero. And so if you really want to, I guess, cross your T's and dot your I's as best as you possibly can, that's potentially not a bad idea, and particularly for some of the, and we'll get into them in a second, some of maybe the more medication type supplements that there aren't batch tested options for as well.
Yeah, I think you're right there, Al. Obviously, if in the event that there was a positive test and you had the batch number there, that's all, well, it's not a guarantee, but what they'll do is go back and the independent laboratories have to store that as well. If they test that and there was a prohibited substance and that matches up, then essentially you will not get banned.
Mm. or at least have it reduced significantly.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, significantly reduced, but if there's proof of no fault, then significantly reduced. So a worthwhile practice, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. So on that topic, there are plenty of different products out there that would probably come under the broad category of supplements that you simply can't get batch tested versions of. So the things that I probably encounter with runners, cyclists and triathletes would be things like iron tablets, which are sold obviously as a pharmaceutical, something like glycerol that might be used for pre-exercise hyperhydration, but is actually sold mostly as a laxative through pharmaceutical means. Raw ingredients, things like maltodextrin that I use quite a lot with my ultra endurance athletes in particular, just to try and reduce the intensity of flavor and reduce the sweetness down in what they're eating and drinking. And even, one thing that probably people don't even think twice about is the bottle of pre-made sports drink, the Gatorades and Powerades you buy from the petrol station. So I guess the question here for these type of products, where there often genuinely is no batch tested version of them or alternative, something like maltodextrin there is, but they're very hard to get, certainly here in Australia anyway. Athletes, should they be concerned about these types of products? Should they be cautious about them? And how do you manage the risk when there isn't a batch tested version of a product that you can go for?
Yeah, it's a great question, Al. And certainly the best way to manage that risk bias would be to use a qualified sports dietitian to assist in making those choices. So I guess the first question for an athlete to ask themselves would be, is it a supplement or a medication? And again, using the SIA app can tease that out. So it's embedded within there, but checking medications in there through a website called Global Dro, very useful to go through that and actually will run you through the process to let you know if that is prohibited or not. Things like drinks and Gatorade. So under our food standards code, how those products are made is they're not made as formulated supplementary sports foods. So to say they're not created under a supplement part of the food code. And this is within the Australian food manufacturing system. They're under a drinks code. And those drinks codes, with obviously dealing with very large companies, Powerade, we've got Coca-Cola, Amatil, like we're dealing with some massive companies with extreme checks and balances towards quality assurance. Obviously, if there was risk there and that had resulted, then I'm sure we would have seen a lot more positive tests. So don't see any issues there. Very low risk. Our single ingredient, things like your glycerol, or maltodextrin.
Yeah.
And again, thinking about that literally has come from the manufacturer and it's being decanted and hasn't had an opportunity to be exposed to cross-contamination, then there should be no risk. And I know we're going to talk about later on, but that was really the premise of our isolated proteins being added into foods and us really understanding the risks around that. So glycerols, maltodextrin. I mean, there's breweries. Some athletes used to get maltodextrin from breweries, believe it or not. So getting the sugar, not the beer, hopefully.
Yep.
But anyhow, so low risk overall, but not black and white, unfortunately. It is a gray space. However, that's why we sort of, with the protein fortified food space, we did have to investigate that further, try and understand it.
Yeah, absolutely. So Just thinking about that, and as you're talking, I can kind of picture there's kind of almost three separate processes that go on from getting raw ingredients into the container that you're then taking it out of to consume. One is a purely pharmaceutical process. So a pharmaceutical company is making a medication probably on their own production line that they own or run exclusively for their products. So that's one aspect, and that would be where your iron tablets come out of that kind of a process, I would imagine. The second process would be the food supply system, and we're going to talk about that in a bit more detail in a minute. So this is where, big food manufacturers will own probably their own production lines, and so they have complete control over everything that goes on in that. They know all the ingredients that are going into it. They're not making supplements, so they're not potentially introducing any kind of banned substances in there unless it's by sabotage or weird contamination with cleaning products, but I can't imagine that would be an issue anyway. So that would be extremely unlikely. And then the third one is the one that you talked about before with the real cross-contamination risk, is where you've got contracted products that are being made in a factory somewhere, who knows where, that make 100 different products for 100 different manufacturers, and they make it in one mixing machine And then next week, they're making a different product on the same machine. The week after, they're making another product. And I think I've even heard examples of where a company bought equipment from someone else, set it up in their own facility, and it was still contaminated. They hadn't cleaned it properly, and then it resulted in cross-contamination from the previous owners of the equipment. But that's unlikely to happen if it's purely in the food supply or purely in sort of your big farmer, I suppose. It's that grey area in between where the contamination is most likely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yep. Totally agree with that.
Yeah, cool. So let's talk about that food side of things now. And you just touched on that with the protein. And I know this is a project that you were heavily involved with in the lead up to the Tokyo Olympics. And one of the reasons we wanted to speak to you today was about that work that you'd done. So do you want to tell us, I guess, where the concern was here? So we have here in Australia, but certainly elsewhere overseas as well, food products that are normal food products but are fortified with protein in some way, shape or form, the high protein breakfast cereal or high protein milk or high protein whatever. And there was a potential concern here about if protein powders were being used to do that fortification and that protein powder was contaminated, could that result in a inadvertent positive through just eating quote-unquote normal food that was just the higher protein version? Is that a kind of reasonable summary of how that project came about?
Yeah, it's a great summary, Al. Yeah, so essentially, back in 2019, we started to see a rise of isolated proteins. So that could be whey proteins, soy proteins, and there's a whole heap of them. And every year I add to that list, I think I've got about 20 on that list. But certainly as how processing technology is improving, we can seemingly extract protein from anything, plant proteins also. So we can now get wheat protein isolate, believe it or not, which is 75% gluten, ironically. And that is added sometimes to muesli bars to fortify or bump up the protein content to get protein prominent on the label. I'm not so sure that if we promoted gluten on the label, it would sell quite as well. So anyhow, but yeah, I've spent a lot of time studying these products that have grown, and I've consumed a lot of them, Al. I didn't actually get paid to eat these things, but the Australian Institute of Sport under Gary Slater were fortunate to find some money to fund an investigation with a Star Setter group of sports dietitians, actually. And essentially, I went and analysed all of these foods and to see what proteins were being added and where they were. And we actually coined the term protein-fortified foods. And these foods are essentially foods that were typically lower in protein, so muesli bars, breads, ice creams, drinks, frozen foods, these kind of things. And yeah, so protein being added, that because the protein-centric society, everyone wants protein, seemingly. So, and one thing we know, if the consumer wants it, that food industry will respond. And hence why we're seeing, and it's still going on, this product. And they don't always have a long product life. And they don't actually always taste that good. The protein popcorn wasn't really a winner. It was a popcorn that had been coated in a whey protein, actually, quite chewy and ordinary. No longer available, I don't believe.
I was going to say I missed that one, so it mustn't have been around for very long.
You didn't miss too much, let me tell you, Al. But anyway, I did manage to finish the packet. So questions were being asked among athletes with protein being on the label. Hey, we've got all this education around doing safe supplements and using batch-tested options, which has grown and been around for a while now. These products have got protein. Are they supplements? Can I take that? Is that a risk of contamination? Then we also had very large sporting organizations using sponsors with some of these foods that were concerned. It was like, hang on a minute, if we're using these sponsors and there's an unknown risk here, the reputational risk to that organization was also coming. And they're like, if we don't know, well, why are we supporting them? Why are we giving our athletes these products? And thirdly, among sports dietitians like ourselves, there was actually questions where practitioners were just not sure. And they were either black or white. I was like, well, any risk, we don't know. So it was an unknown risk, essentially. So I was deemed the right person to go and try all these foods. And photos, plenty of photos, plenty of consumption. And coming out and just really trying to understand when And it's an easy recommendation for any athlete. Is it a supplement or is it a protein fortified food? For example, a muesli bar typically lower in protein. So these soy protein or soy protein crisps are then added just to get that protein up. And if we think, and it only needs to be above 5 grams per serve to get protein on that label. And as we know, well, it's I actually use that as a good opportunity to work with an athlete because they see protein and they think, what are your requirements? Is it post-work at this? Can this be useful? So it actually can be used in a good way there, but also acknowledging that any protein, whether it's meat or anything, protein is expensive. So when protein is added to food, you should expect that food, whether it's a muesli bar or an ice cream or a pasta, or a bread, it will be more expensive. So proteins in general are expensive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so I guess as part of that, it sounds like you had a few job perks in terms of getting to try all these products. But in terms of the actual work, was that actually going out to the food companies that were making these products and actually chatting to them and finding out what their processes were and then tracing back all the raw ingredients all the way back to the source? Is that sort of how you had to go about it?
Yeah, so unfortunately it was hampered through COVID. So we did do a desktop audit. However, I did manage to interview with several very large Australian manufacturers of some of these cereal-based products and were fortunate to get into really try and understand their processes. As I said, that quality assurance around ingredients and their own testing. And certainly one thing that we learned from that, due to the cost barriers, it is highly unlikely that we're going to see a batch tested, muesli nut bar with some added protein. That's just not going to happen. So we also tried to get in touch with some smaller food manufacturers. Unfortunately, they all declined to be interviewed, which is unfortunate. Whether it was just a knowledge around what we were actually trying to find out, we're merely just trying to understand the processes around it, small versus large. But certainly from our findings was that the checks and balances around individual ingredients that are used by large companies controlling their own manufacture under the Australian Food Standards Code is deeming these products actually low risk. So no additional risk to other general food manufacturing products.
Yeah. And if I understand this correctly, the reason for that is because when you're making your protein fortified muesli bars or bread or whatever it is, and you're buying the soy protein or the soy protein crisps or something, the protein or the source of protein is kind of from the original sort of manufacturers of the raw ingredients that are taken from harvesting the soybeans and turning them into protein powder, essentially. So that protein that they're then using to put into those foods haven't gone out to supplement land where all those mixes are, where the risk of cross-contamination occurs, and then come back again. They've sourced them directly from the raw ingredient suppliers in the first place, so they've never gone and been exposed to other ingredients. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, whether that's a pallet of, 20 kilo bags of isolated proteins or soybean crisps. And I guess it's a good opportunity to talk about, even if we think about whey powder, so obviously proteins, like there's not tens and tens of companies that produce these things. Most of them come from a very small number of very large producers around the world. And similarly with soy protein. So soy protein isolate crisps is the most common protein that is used to fortify these protein fortified foods that I've found, whether that's a plant-based ready meal or a muesli bar. So the soy protein is certainly that, and that they make a crisp as well. It's from one of the largest producers of soy protein in the world.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. And because they're buying it as the raw ingredient as opposed to a finished product that they're then adding in, that's, I guess, the key difference there. And I know just from seeing you present that work in the past when you sort of first finished it, there was one category that athletes do need to be wary about where contamination may come into foods that they purchase that are kind of seemingly normal foods, so to speak, that might be protein fortified.
Good point, Al. So yeah, as far as higher risk PFFs, protein fortified foods, would be foods that are available from cafes and food outlets, for example. So your protein balls that may be down at the local cafe that they've made out the back, obviously quite easy to make. Or an example locally that I've seen actually is an acai smoothie bar down here that had the protein powder that they use for their smoothies. And they literally, there was a ASN supplement store 50 meters away, and they'd seen that, and they were just using whatever's cheapest at the time. I actually asked them, which was an imported American protein powder. Could still be low risk, unknown, really, I don't know, but it certainly wasn't batch tested, and that was being used for their thing. So I guess that's obviously higher risk than something that's fully being controlled. And I guess another example where an athlete who's been in the system may ask then, who's had the previous ASADA education around the boost juiced example, which some would know, where it's, you know, getting added protein to a smoothie there. And from our conversation that we've just had, if someone said, well, if it's an isolated protein and it's just from the, and that's actually added to a boost juice smoothie, why is that higher risk? And it's a question that I did ask myself when looking into it. Essentially, the protein the large company actually used last time I looked at that wasn't an isolated protein in itself. It was actually a supplement. So it had 3 or 4 ingredients. I'm assuming the reason for that would be to reduce the cost of that. Had other things like glycine and other ingredients. So it wasn't an isolated ingredient. So that's sort of my defense. I've never been asked that question, but anyway, I've asked myself, and that's how I answered it.
Yeah. And I guess those sort of small business owners that are running cafes or smoothie bars and things like that, as you said, like they're buying their protein powder retail like the rest of us. They're not getting it in bulk from the raw ingredient suppliers like a big multinational food company would get. And so the product they're buying is exposed to the same risk as if you bought your protein powder or whatever supplement online.
Correct. And it's probably a good time to mention botanical ingredients. We're seeing the rise of plant-based botanical ingredients. So at this stage, that's an unknown risk. Our research project didn't actually look at that, but that is the next trend, which I'm seeing now, which is essentially like probiotic fortified or these botanical fortified little shots, which are rising. I'm sure you've seen it all. So at this stage, for us, it's a gray area. It's a supplement. Yeah, it's, you know, safe would be, you know, trying to, there's no batch tested options at this stage. So do you actually need that? If it's probiotic, what's your goal? Look, there's other options. Like, I don't think you're missing out, but there certainly seems to be a lot of hype. And that's where it's heading now, is around, these fortified botanicals. So again, that would be considered higher risk due to the fact that it's unknown. And the final one, I guess, is foods with hemp ingredients. We didn't specifically test any hemp foods, but from our interviews with Husta, certainly when products, from the feedback that we got, the risk, it's not worth it. Variable inherent concentrations, which can vary significantly, or for tetrahydrocannabinol or THC, which can result in a positive doping test in competition. So avoiding all hemp ingredients. And also understanding that when we use one specific ingredient, there's a lot of processing that's actually really concentrated. So things like heavy metals and that and other potential contaminants are actually concentrated, and that's one ingredient. So then when you've got these multi-ingredient, we've seen the back of some of these labels. I mean, a greens powder is an example of that, where they're just throwing massive amounts of ingredients in there at minute amounts. And then you go through, and I have about the time to do, I was interested to do that amount versus what we recommend. But there's concentration amongst all these areas, and you're combining that. So it's really... Yeah, acknowledging where the ingredients come from as well, and essentially just putting more of these highly concentrated multi-ingredient things in it, consuming them. Our liver and our kidneys do have to process them at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, contamination isn't just about banned substances and fair sport. It's about health as well. And so we need to consider that. And there has been, again, stories in the past of, you know, heavy metals and things turning up in quantities that probably are greater than what we'd like to see in things that we're putting in our mouth.
Oh, for sure. And certainly to the uni students that I talk to, and it's a very rare occasion, but, you know, examples of hepatotoxicity where, you know, for some reason a human has responded and their liver has actually. So, you know, I'm trying to scare people here, but it's just, It's just not about throwing every concentrated thing in the system, I think, trying to be smart about it.
Yep. All right. So bringing all this together, I think we've sort of covered off the big issues here in terms of, you know, what can cause potentially contamination, how to kind of try and minimize that risk. In terms of, I guess, where listeners can go to get more information on this topic, obviously Australian listeners, probably the Sports Integrity Australia app is a good place to start.
Definitely. Yes, on there. So we've got there the Australian Institute of Sport, the supplement page on there, recently always updated, only going from strength to strength, awesome resource there. And yep, the SIA app, and we've got Sports Dietitians Australia if you really do want to use a professional to assist you wherever, or if there's any reason why getting your sport to engage for them with other people for a workshop or something. So there's definitely no shortage of information out there, Alan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for overseas listeners, obviously it'll be different in different countries. I know in the UK, for example, different sort of sports health professionals are certified as UK anti-doping advisors. I'm not 100% across what all of that means because I've never had to do it. But obviously there'll be a different process in each country. So if you're not in Australia, obviously try and find out a bit more about that or contact kind of your association for dietitians or sports nutrition professionals in your country as appropriate, for sure. Okay, so let's finish up with our bonus round, Kerry, where we get to find out a little bit more about you outside of what we've just discussed. So the first question, and I think you might have alluded to this a little bit before, but that's more so maybe your career rather than yourself. Have you been involved in any particular sports yourself as a participant, either in the past or currently?
Yeah, not currently engaged in anything else, trying to preserve the tendons and soft tissue at this stage, but previously history in AFL. And rugby union.
There you go.
So, yeah.
The cross coder.
Yes.
Now, I believe dietetics was a career change for you. Do you want to tell us what you were doing before that and I guess what prompted the shift into nutrition?
Yeah, so I think I mentioned at the start, but I did an undergrad in sports science and was very passionate about strength and conditioning training, working in the field of contact sports. Yep. And essentially there, being exposed to athletes and having a lot of time to develop relationships and building a lot of trust with athletes, I was getting a lot of questions around nutrition, actually, and supplements, ironically. And I found myself in a position where I did want to know more about sports nutrition to give the right answers, and also being exposed to an absolute gun in Kelly Hogan, mm-hmm. sure you know, as far as, so that's, I was fortunate to be able to assist Kelly in some of the work she was doing there. So that was really prompted the move, and then I did the IOC diploma in sports nutrition, and wasn't actually planning on going back to uni to do a master's, but yeah, eventually realized, thanks to the assistance of Louise Burke, that to work in high performance sport that I had to be a dietitian first. So back to uni for me, Al, for another 2 years, and essentially ended up working in doing all sports nutrition now. The plan was to do a dual role and do strength conditioning and nutrition, but as you know, in these elite environments, you don't always get paid for having that additional skill set. So for me, certainly getting enough work as a sports dietitian at this stage and loving it.
Yeah, awesome. And shout out to Kelly Hogan. I think that's really on topic because she's a founder of a website that's exclusively sells batch tested products. So there you go.
Yeah, great point. Yeah. She is a legend.
Yep. Anything on your bucket list that you haven't yet done?
Too many to mention, unfortunately, at this stage, Al. However, after reading the book recently, Die With Zero, my framework is pending and currently changing. So, yeah, to be continued there.
Yep, fair enough. Is there a particular event or events that you're most looking forward to at the Paris Olympics this year, either just because you like the sports or because you're maybe working with those athletes and you've got a bit of a vested interest in it?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely biased and working, keen to see what we can do in BMX freestyle. We've got the current gold medalist there in Logan Martin, and also surfing to see what we can do there. So, yeah, obviously traditional 100-meter sprint stuff. Yeah, there's just too much to mention there, but definitely biased in where I'm currently working.
Yep. And is there an athlete going to Paris who's potentially not a household name, but you think we might be worth looking out for?
Yeah, so they've done some work recently with a 17-year-old Northern Rivers man, breakdancing athlete actually, called Jeff Dunn, mm-hmm. who's recently qualified. So he is going to Paris I think I believe it's the first time that breakdancing, obviously a new one for many, and a topic of conversation for many. However, I'll be keen to see what he can do. Great kid. So I'll be following his movements, definitely.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. And final question, do you have a favorite piece of advice or motto?
Yeah, look, it's not an uncommon one, but one that I continually go back to since 2010 is that no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care, which certainly reiterates the importance of building trusting relationships with athletes, clients. And as you know, that does take time. I guess my only caveat to that motto is except for your own kids. Because they don't really care how much you know, even though they know you care. So,
very true.
That's it from me, Al.
Very true. That's why you don't work with family.
Exactly. That's right. They don't pay either, unfortunately.
No, that's true. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time, Kerry. It's great to hear about a topic that I think lots of people kind of sort of know little bits and pieces about, but don't necessarily have the full picture on. And to get a bit of the backstory about some of these issues as well. So thanks so much for your time. And we look forward to seeing how the breakdancers, the BMX freestylers and the surfers go in Paris this year.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for the opportunity, Al. And still getting through your ebook, but great work on that.
Yeah, awesome.
Great
thank
piece
you.
Of work. So thank you.
Cheers. All right, thank you so much, Kerry, for some great insights into the risks and how to mitigate those. So to quickly summarize, can my supplement really cause a positive doping test? Well, yes, and it's not just elite athletes that need to be aware of this. That said, some types of supplement products are certainly riskier than others, and there are ways to mitigate that risk as well. So we can generally think of the way that supplements are manufactured in kind of one of three processes. So firstly, we have large pharmaceutical companies making more of what I would consider like the medication type supplement products. So this is things like vitamin and mineral tablets, things like sodium bicarbonate tablets, which are called Sodabic that you can buy through pharmacies, things like glycerol and so on. Now, these are almost never batch tested because they're really designed for clinical use, not for athletic use. But they're also not considered really a huge concern in most cases because they're usually made on dedicated production lines controlled by the company with very strict quality control processes in place that are required for all pharmaceuticals. Now, the second process is where you have large food manufacturers who source large quantities of raw ingredients that are used in some supplements. So these are things like pure maltodextrin, glucose powder, or raw protein powders, soy protein crisps, and these sorts of things. And they use these to either fortify everyday food products, like the protein fortified breads, cereals, cereal bars, and so on that Kerry was talking about, or to make basic sports foods or fluids in-house. So these are things like your standard, your off-the-shelf, ready-to-drink sports drinks like Gatorade and Powerade, etc. So that's the second process. And then the third process is where you have small companies and supplement companies that don't own or have their own in-house production lines, and instead they use contractors to make their products for them. The contractors source the raw ingredients and then blend them in large machines to make a batch of that product. They package them, apply the labels, and send them back to the supplement company to on-sell to retail outlets or directly to the public. Now, these production lines, therefore, are used for many different products, and they're very difficult to clean perfectly, as Kerry talked about. And therefore, there is a significant risk of cross-contamination if another product that contains a banned substance was previously made on that same production line with the same equipment. So this is where you're most likely to see the high-risk supplements, where contamination and risk of an inadvertent doping incident is most likely to occur. Now, on the topic of supplements that are made that contain banned substances, we also need to remember that some products have banned substances purposefully added to them. Now, that can either be declared on the label, so there's no deception going on here, it's just a product that is not appropriate for use in a WADA-compliant setting, or the banned substance has been added to it without declaring it on the label. So this is clearly a deceptive practice, usually in order to make their product seem better than it is. Now, most products in these categories, one way or the other, are usually multi-ingredient supplements marketed to the bodybuilders and others in the gym and fitness industry. But but they're often used by athletes across all sports, and that includes endurance sports. So things like some of your multi-ingredient protein products with a whole bunch of added ingredients, pre-workout products, these sorts of things is where you're likely to see this risk being quite significant. Now, to minimize the risk of a banned substance inadvertently entering your body through supplement use, whether it's through cross-contamination or through the deliberate addition of banned substances to a product by the manufacturer, choosing batch-tested products wherever possible is going to minimize that risk. So examples of batch testing are Informed Sport, which is available in the UK, the US, and Australia, amongst other countries, or HUSTA, which is a more specific batch testing certification that's done here in Australia. Now, if you're unsure about products, you can always check, certainly here in Australia, with the Sports Integrity Australia app, or a sports dietitian who is well across the risks and precautions around supplements and doping. Remember, there is no such thing as a WADA, an SIA, a USADA approved supplement. Anti-doping agencies do not approve supplements in any shape or form. There is no endorsement. There is no, yes, you can use this product and it's not a problem. That does not exist. We need to get rid of this myth that's going around and has been going around for years. Now, remember, if you enter any sporting event that is organized by a club or an organization affiliated with a national sporting organization that is a signatory to the WADA code through its international body, then you are essentially agreeing to comply with the WADA code. And theoretically, you can be randomly tested at any event. And as we heard, it does happen from time to time. Now, this also includes other major event organizers. Ironman, for example, are a signatory to the WADA code as well. Going through the anti-doping rule violation process is an incredibly stressful experience, even for amateur athletes, and the potential sanctions can remove you from any association with the sport and its events for up to 4 years. So even if you think the risk is very low, even if you think the chances of being tested are very, very low, it's still a good idea to be mindful of this and do everything that you can in your power to avoid the risk of contaminated supplements causing a positive doping test should you be tested. Okay, so that is going to do it for this episode. So let's look ahead. Next week, we have our next episode of T-12. So we're up to 8 weeks to go. So T-8 next week. And we're going to check in with our guest athlete, Brett Kennedy, as he's preparing for his 100-kilometer Ultra Trail Australia in just 8 weeks' time. So in this episode, we're going to focus on his nutrition for the day before and the morning of the race and get him going with trying that in some of his training, as well as reviewing his progress from last time around his sweat rate testing and his gut training as well. Now, just to wrap up, a reminder that if you do have a question that you would like answered on the podcast, you can contact us at Fueling Endurance on Instagram, Facebook, or Threads, or Fuel Endurance on X. And we have actually had someone do this just recently and suggest an episode that will be coming in the pipeline over the next few months. Thanks to people who have left ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We really do appreciate it. If you do listen on one of these platforms and you've got 30 seconds when the episode finishes, I'd love it if you could just leave a quick rating or review. It certainly helps the podcast and helps get the message out to other people as well. And remember, now there is 75 previous questions that we've already answered on the podcast. So if you are new to the podcast, welcome. You may like to go and check out the back catalog to see if there's something there that will be helpful to you. Most podcast apps only show the last few episodes, but you can click back and you'll find them going all the way back to November 2020. If you want to be notified every time a new episode is available, you can hit subscribe on the podcast app that you're listening to this on. And if your friends are asking about a particular nutrition issue for their training or their racing, and you've heard it here on the podcast, you might like to let them know. You can now get your hands on the ebook through fuelingendurance.com as well, and we really appreciate that it supports the cost of maintaining this podcast. But that's it from me for today. Have a great week, everyone. We'll be back with our catch up with Brett Kennedy next week. But until then, have a great week.